This is the Iowa Art Showcase, Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program dedicated to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. This month, we'll head down the Mississippi to check out a visiting Titanic artifact exhibition in Dubuque, and we'll investigate several special events commemorating 10-plus 90 years of art at Davenport's Figge. We'll zip to Cedar Rapids to hear how Tim Hankowich intends to celebrate his 10th season with Orchestra Iowa. And we'll catch up with three dignitaries, the internationally known music director of the new Sousa Band, who is bringing the band to Iowa, a music legend who recently became an Iowan magazine icon, and a musician who's receiving a major award from the National Flute Association. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
Since I found out about the award a year ago, it has sort of dominated my life in that, you know, I'm not just passively accepting the award like some old retired guy, but I'm actually doing some stuff at the convention that is going to be very challenging for me, you know, and performing some difficult music from memory and so forth. So after our interview today, I'm going to head home and get the flute out and put in my practice and hope things go well at the convention. So in a way, I'm looking forward to receiving the award, and I'm also looking forward to afterwards when I can say, hey, I've got my life back now.
Composer, conductor, and flutist Harvey Solberger. Later this month, he'll receive the National Flute Association's 2015 Lifetime Achievement Award. Harvey grew up in Cedar Rapids and Marion. He started playing the accordion at 4 and won his first contest at 5. He caught flute fever at 15, studied with Julia Denneke, played in the Cedar Rapids Symphony and Municipal Band, and studied with Betty Bang Mather at the University of Iowa, where he received his bachelor's degree. A Woodrow Wilson Fellowship propelled him to Columbia University, where, as a graduate student, he studied composition with Jack Beason. While still at Columbia, Harvey, Charles Warnin, and Joel Krosnick joined forces to create the Group for Contemporary Music. In New York, Harvey started making a name for himself as a performer, conductor, and a composer of new music. Also along the way, Harvey became known for his groundbreaking extended flute performance techniques.
You know, I should say that the thing that perhaps has defined my career as a flutist has been the sense I've had since about 1959 or 60 when I was in Iowa City, and then afterwards in my years in New York, the sense I had that the flute could do much more expressively than it had been called to do up to that point. You know, every instrument has sort of a rap sheet, a kind of a character that's assigned to it. The trumpet is seen as very masculine and martial, you know, calling us to battle or to the parade. The flute is seen as quite the opposite, very pastoral, very sweet, very goody-two-shoes. And I had the feeling, you know, that the flute could express a wider range of emotional, expressive possibilities. And I was led forward in that direction by some music from Europe, especially a wonderful solo flute piece by the Italian composer Luciano Berio, who wrote a work in 1958 called Sequenza for solo flute, which I think was kind of a bull in a china shop. It just completely rearranged our whole perception of the flute, and that was partly through the way it was played by the person for whom it was written, an Italian flutist named Severino Gazzoloni, who was also a kind of distant model for me. So my mission, I felt, in the 60s was this business of experimenting with and expanding the range, the voice of the flute. And that involved not just conceptual issues, but also technical issues. And so I was, I think, one of the first people who was exploring what have come to be called extended techniques. That is, the development, the use musically of certain sounds on the flute that hadn't been thought about or exploited before. So that occupied me a lot during that period. And probably the work that best expresses or sums up that work was a piece that I wrote for solo flute in 1973 and 4. The work is called Riding the Wind, which is taken from an ancient book of Chinese philosophy. But the idea of riding the wind, that's what we do as wind players, as flutists. And that sort of was a summation of all that work I'd done. Since then, I still use these techniques. They're still important, but I use them less self-consciously. You know, they're just part of my vocabulary. They're not something new now that I'm exploring. They have taken their place in the music of many people who have written for the flute.
Well, you were the second American to play that sequenza, weren't you?
Yes. A colleague of mine in New York named John Paris had played it first in Tanglewood, I think in 1959, when Berio was there. I remember, you know, that piece caused quite a stir among flutists, and I had many colleagues who, like myself, had it on their music stand. But because of the way it was notated, and because of how far it departed from the way the flute was normally used, most people didn't know quite what to do with it or how to begin learning it. Because the sequenza, among other things, you know, the flute comes right out of the gate being almost spitting. The flute can express rage. It can express such a wide range of emotions. And I think the first job was conceptually in our minds, in our brains, to deal with the reimagining of the instrument in that way. And I worked for a long time on the piece and worked with Berio on it. For me, you know, it was a very liberating piece of music, and it liberated me to move in forward in those same directions. And, you know, that's how it is in music, I think. Composers are influenced. There's something in the past that they encounter affects them, and then it stimulates them in their own explorations and their own experiments, perhaps toward achievements that are very different from what the person who created the initial piece that was the stimulation had in mind at all. And so it goes. We're all part of a great human chain of consciousness. And yes, we do recognize certain names, Beethoven, Aaron Copland, what have you. But I tend to think beyond the individuality of the individual links of that chain, there is a chain of consciousness that keeps growing and expanding as time passes and one generation passes on what it knows to the next.
Well, tell us about some of the places where you have taught and sort of how you have transpired until getting here to Iowa.
After teaching at Columbia and the Manhattan School of Music in New York City, I moved to Bloomington, Indiana, and taught in the School of Music of Indiana University for 9 years. And in 1992, I was invited to teach at the University of California, San Diego. And I went there primarily as a conductor, actually. So, you know, at the Manhattan School in New York, I was conducting and teaching flute. At Indiana, I was conducting and teaching composition. In San Diego, my main job was conducting, and that led me to conduct the La Jolla Symphony, which was connected with the university. And subsequent to that, when I retired from teaching in 2008, my wife, Marla, who is from Strawberry Point, wanted to return home to Strawberry Point, where her family lives. So you could say I'm living in Strawberry Point for love, really, you know, because the person I love, it was very important for her to live there.
Congratulations to composer, conductor, and flutist Harvey Solberger. Harvey will receive a Distinguished Lifetime Achievement Award at the National Flute Association's annual convention later this month. In addition to his recognition, he will be honored with a concert of two of his works. They'll present a flute masterclass on three of his compositions. And at the convention, he'll present a concert of his silent film suite in collaboration with Iowa's Red Cedar Chamber Music and historian Michael Zaz. You can hear all of Harvey's interview by clicking on the Iowa Art Showcase link under the Classical drop-down menu on our iowapublicradio.org website. Just ahead, we'll investigate art and architects at the Figge. We'll track Bob Dorr as he backs into icon status. We'll explore the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's largest visiting exhibit. We'll talk to Keith Bryan about his two concerts in Iowa with the new Sousa Band. And you'll hear about Orchestra Iowa's upcoming season. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. This year marks Tim Hangowich's 10th season as music director and conductor of Orchestra Iowa. The symphony celebrates by presenting 16 diverse performances. The season kicks off with an outdoor concert on September 12th on the front lawn of the historic Brusmer Mansion in Cedar Rapids. Tim Hangowich.
Brusmer has always been probably the flagship of our season, and it was born out of the flood of 2008, and it's been a tradition ever since. And so what we're going to be performing this time is Dvorak's Symphony No. 9 from the New World, and Smetana's Moldau from Mavlost. But I'm most excited about what we're doing on the second half. We're performing Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, but in a manner that is kind of unusual. Although originally it was scored just for symphony orchestra, I'm going to put together a large all-male chorus, a chorus of about 150 men who will sing the very opening by themselves, and it gives a very, very Russian flavor to it, as well as they come in at the very end to sing God Save the Tsar at the end. And interspersed in the middle of the piece are some Russian folk melodies for children, and so our very own Discovery Children's Chorus are going to be joining us on stage. And one of the curiosities of this program is a piece that I have arranged for the occasion. Because we're putting together this men's chorus, which is quite unusual, and the sound that they'll make is really extraordinary, I wanted to also showcase that just for another piece. And even though my last name is Hankowicz, which is Ukrainian, on my mother's side, I am Welsh. And there is a long-standing tradition of men's choruses that sang in the coal mines in Wales. And so I set a very nationalistic, patriotic melody from Wales called March of the Men of Harlech. And I've set that for men's chorus and symphony orchestra, and it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
Two more Masterwork concerts are part of Orchestra Iowa's fall lineup, including their October A National Romance concert and their November program called The Fifth Season. In January, members of Orchestra Iowa will perform in the pit for the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Verdi's La Traviata under Daniel Kleinknecht. Orchestra Iowa also continues their outreach throughout the state.
We started a new series, and we call it Orchestra Iowa on the Road. Almost every one of our symphonic programs in Cedar Rapids is repeated in Iowa City and Coralville. But we also go to Davenport for our Nutcracker performances and also the completion of our Stravinsky triptych, arguably the three greatest works of the 20th century written by Stravinsky. Last year we performed The Rite of Spring, and this year we will be completing that triptych by performing Petrushka and The Firebird, and that will be both in Cedar Rapids and in Davenport. We also go to Independence this season as we perform in Cedar Rapids, and then we take the program that includes a Mozart bassoon concerto featuring our very own principal bassoonist Matt Ransom to Independence, and they have just opened a wonderful new facility. Their high school has a state-of-the-art performance venue, and we want to share our art with them as well as work with their band and music programs. And then finally, one work that I'm most looking forward to is a performance of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. And this is an outreach to Simpson College in Indianola, and we will be performing it both in Cedar Rapids and in Indianola, and very likely will be televised on Iowa Public Television.
And that Missa Solemnis is part of your Masterwork series. Mm-hmm. You also have three chamber series, and then you have expanded your pop series.
Yes. One of the big success stories of our organization has been the growth of our chamber series. And our first chamber program is entitled Russian Troika, and it features music from the Romantic to the late Romantic to the early 20th century. There's a work by Khachaturian for a trio for clarinet, piano, and violin. And one of my favorite composers is Prokofiev. And this work that we're performing is the Overture on Hebrew Themes for Clarinet, String Quartet, and Piano. And then there's something that is one of the great staples of the repertoire is the Tchaikovsky String Quartet No. 1 in D Major, which is just sublimely beautiful, just filled with great melody after great melody. And then there's our second chamber program called The French Kiss. And it includes a variety of French composers from various periods and styles, not the least of which is François Couperin, the great Baroque composer, who wrote this work called The Apotheosis of Corelli. And that's an opportunity for us to showcase one of our latest purchases, which is this amazingly beautiful harpsichord. We have a romantic work by Saint-Saëns, which is unusual because it's a septet for trumpet. Yes, trumpet, string quintet, and piano. And then finally, one of the most emotionally charged works in the repertoire is the piano quintet in F minor by César Franck, and that'll be a spectacular program.
And then what is your final?
So our May Chamber program is entitled Tricksters and Troubadours because there's works on this program that are inspired by stories and music from either the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, but reinterpreted in a more modern context. There's a work by Millot that is based on medieval folklore. There's an American work by Charles Warrenen called the Glogauer Liederbuch, which is amazing as it takes a lot of Renaissance melodies and refashions it using modern orchestration, and it's one of the coolest things in the entire season. And then there's an arrangement of Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel for wind ensemble that is very charming and very witty. And for those in your listening audience who know about Till Eulenspiegel, he's this prankster whose story originates from the Middle Ages.
And then tell us about a couple of these Pops concerts that you're going to be having.
We have an exciting Pops lineup for this upcoming season. We have two amazing programs that I know that the entire family is going to love. Not the least of which is our February Pops called Disney in Concert, which has a subtitle, Tale as Old as Time. And this features some of the great musical numbers from Beauty and the Beast and Cinderella and the Little Mermaid and the Lion King and, of course, Frozen. So parents out there, you need to bring your little princesses and princes to this program. This is something that everyone is going to absolutely love. And then something that's a little bit more up-tempo is something that we call Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. They are a swing band on steroids, I like to describe them as such, and they have the entire orchestra behind them jumping and a-jiving all night long, and it's just high-energy swing that's sure to put a big smile on your face. And then finally, and this is probably one of the most exciting things that we've done in a long time, separate from our Pops program is an October gala performance that's designed to kick off the season and also be a significant fundraiser for Orchestra Iowa. And that is to share the stage with the great artist Bernadette Peters, one of the great icons of Broadway. She's just an amazing performer, and she'll be performing music from her famous roles ranging from Into the Woods to Sunday in the Park with George and Gypsy and A Little Night Music. But whether she sings some of the American Songbook or from some of her starring roles from Broadway, this is going to be a night to remember.
Tim continues.
Some of the initiatives that we're doing also partner with local community organizations. And there's this one January symphonic concert called Stirring Fantasies, which is a play on words because most of the music on that particular program is for string ensemble, like the Vaughan Williams Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis or the Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings. And on top of that is a really amazing arrangement of the Carmen Suite, the music of which is by Bizet, but it is reorchestrated by a contemporary Russian composer named Shishedrin, and it's scored for string orchestra and percussion. And what we're going to do is we've invited some of the area's string programs to join us on stage prior to that concert, or a mini concert of their own. And then musically, one of the big programs is our last program of the season in June, featuring Richard Strauss's Ein Heldenleben, one of the great tone poems of his compositional output, and it's one of the most difficult and one of the most significant works for large symphony orchestra. So I'm really proud to be able to include on this program repertoire called A Hero's Life, featuring works by Sibelius and Wagner and Dvorak, all of which center their music around a particular folk hero, only to end the program with this great monument, Ein Heldenleben by Richard Strauss, which means A Hero's Life.
Orchestra Iowa's music director and conductor Tim Hankowicz, celebrating his 10th season with the symphony. To get more information about concerts and tickets, go to orchestraiowa.org. Don't go away. Bob Dorr graces the cover of the Iowan magazine. A 5,000-square-foot exhibit featuring all aspects of the Titanic is currently on display in Iowa. The new Sousa Band plays some audience favorites, and two anniversaries mark the creation of one distinctive museum. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. 2015 commemorates the 10th anniversary of the opening of the Figge Art Museum and also the 90th anniversary of the opening of the Figge's predecessor, the Davenport Municipal Art Gallery. It all started when a former mayor offered his collection to the city with a stipulation that they open an art museum in Davenport. Figge executive director and a newly elected member in the Association of Art Museum Directors, Tim Schiffer.
We're celebrating a kind of a legacy of art here.
And it started out with 350 pieces, but now how many works do you have?
The city owns all the pieces that were purchased when it was a city museum. So there's just under 4,000 pieces in that collection, which includes the Grant Wood Archive, which is very significant, and a large Haitian art collection, a Spanish viceregal collection. And then there's about 700 pieces that we've collected since the Figge opened. And we're actually having a show of new acquisitions that were given to us in honor of the anniversary. So that's exciting. So it's growing all the time.
Part of this celebration is you're going to be bringing back the architect. So tell us about this, and then tell us a little bit about this architect.
Sir David Chipperfield. He wasn't a sir when he designed this building. This was one of his first big commissions, actually, and his first commission in the United States. And he's gone on to be really one of the leading, I would call him a classical modernist architect. And he designs buildings in the Middle East, in Asia, all over Europe. And so we're very proud to have an iconic work by a great architect here. And so we wanted to bring him back and celebrate that. He will be speaking here in September, and we're publishing a book about the museum, about its history, and about the building, and about the collection in celebration of the anniversaries. And we're kind of poising it as launching us into the future, like what's the next phase? Because we're going to, you know, be working on building our endowment, doing some changes to the museum. It's a good opportunity to launch that.
So you're going to have a special exhibit with Sir David Chipperfield that you are going to have some of his original designs and show how the whole Figge Museum came together.
He was chosen through a competition, and so they sent out requests all over the world, and there was a committee that was put together, and so they selected six architects from the U.S., Europe, South America, that they interviewed. And they ended up selecting David Chipperfield, which was kind of an unusual choice because, like, Richard Meyer was one of the people, and he designed the Getty Museum in L.A. So Chipperfield was much less known than some of the other candidates, but they chose him. And he went through kind of a design process over a couple of years of developing the idea for the building. But some of the original sketches show a glass box on the river. That was one of his original concepts. And so we're doing a show of the development of the design because it went through two very distinct phases, from the first design to then the final design. And what he ended up with is this green glass box on the river. And the idea was that the two walls of glass create a translucent building that reflects the weather and kind of reflects the idea of the river and water and that kind of green look, which it really does change according to the day. So we're doing a show about that with the original models and the drawings and a little bit about the history of the museum and the people, the Figge family, that they gave the naming gift for the building, and to kind of wrap it all up.
When you enter through the front side of the building, it has kind of a texture to it or something underneath it. So kind of describe that.
The glass has stripes that are called fritting that are fired onto the glass. So the stripes, when you see it from afar, it makes the building both reflective and translucent so that it kind of gives it this semi-transparent feeling to it. And the building is designed with a very severe grid. So there are these panels, and each pane of glass is about 10 feet wide and about 4 feet high. and there's over 1,000 panels, but the whole building is made according to that unit of kind of building blocks. And I think it's an example of kind of the international style, very severe modern architecture of Mies van der Rohe, which he quotes in his design process, of really paring architecture down to the most pure elements. And I think it works very well for an art museum because it's based kind of on this classical idea of architecture. And a lot of architecture is going in a different, if you think Frank Gehry, it's all curves, it's very Baroque, it's very non-geometric. Chipperfield is much more classical. And he actually just got the commission to do a new modern wing onto the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which kind of is, you know, classically designed building. So we're very happy about that because that shows that we were on the right track from the very beginning.
Tell us some other unique features about the Figge Museum that Chipperfield added to the design.
Well, from the second and a half floor up to the fourth floor, we have the Winter Garden, which is a giant light-filled space. It's about 60 feet high on the inside, and it looks directly out on the river. And so it's the best place to view the river in the Quad Cities at all times of the year, because you can be up there in a snowstorm and watch the storm come down the river. But it is just a beautiful space.
So when exactly is Sir David Chipperfield going to be at the Figge?
He is here the 9th, 10th, and 11th of September, and that's going to be the celebration. And we have free admission to September 20th for our special exhibitions, and it's a way to kind of reintroduce the museum to the community and welcome them in.
So tell us about this visiting exhibit that you have that is so important, and you wanted to include it in the celebration of your anniversary.
The exhibit is called American Moderns on Paper, Masterworks from the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art. And the Wadsworth Athenaeum is in Hartford, Connecticut. It's one of the oldest museums in the United States, and they have a really unparalleled collection of works on paper by American artists. It's something they've collected for over 100 years. So this show is really the early to mid-20th century in the United States, and it's when the center of art in the world shifted from Europe to the United States. So it starts really around 1913 when they had the Armory Show in New York, and it was the introduction of avant-garde art to the American public, which the public actually ridiculed, but the artists were very influenced. And so it was the first time Picasso and Matisse and Duchamp and some of the really avant-garde artists from Paris had been shown in a big public exhibition. And so this show is really the artists from that period who created an American form of contemporary art. So it's Georgia O'Keeffe, Edward Hopper, John Maron, Andrew Wyeth, and a lot of other ones. Arthur Dove, who was really the first abstract painter from the United States. And so it really looks at that kind of key period in American art history. And one of our goals is to bring world-class art to the Quad Cities so that you would see the same quality of shows that you would see in Chicago or New York. And so we wanted to bring something special to the Quad Cities for our anniversary. And works on paper, because they're more personal, I'd say, than, you know, more developed works, it's a nice kind of intimate look at how these artists are thinking.
The Figge Art Museum's executive director, Tim Schiffer. The Figge also has several other anniversary exhibits. In the community gallery, they have a show called My Figge, which features works by community artists expressing their feelings about the Figge. On the Figge's Bechtel Plaza, they are showcasing a temporary sculpture installation by Terry Rathje. And they have an exhibition of gifts to the Figge collection for their 10th anniversary. Free admission to the Figge continues through September 20th. To find out more details, go to figgeartmuseum.org. Just ahead, some artifacts from the Titanic are on view in Iowa. soprano Virginia Crosskerry joins the New Sousa Band on stage. And Iowa blues legend Bob Doerr was recently promoted to the ranks of Iowa icon. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The Iowa icon thing just makes me chuckle. I try not to take any of that very seriously, but it really has been a fantastic honor and a fantastic experience for me.
Host of Iowa Public Radio's Backtracks, Blue Avenue, and Beatles Medley, Iowa Public TV MC and host, and lead singer and harmonica performer in Bob Doerr and the Blue Band, the blues man himself, Bob Doerr. Bob was recently profiled and bestowed by the Iowan magazine with icon status. The publication saves this honor for exceptional Iowans who stand for something. They added Bob to their select group because of his outstanding musical talent and professionalism. They also featured him in an article and on the cover of their July and August issue of the Iowan magazine. When Bob was in eighth grade, his family moved to Davenport from Oak Park, Illinois. During high school, Bob was a drummer in a band called the Tortoise and the Hare. His love and skill at playing football brought him to the University of Northern Iowa. Once he got to UNI, he ended up dropping football and started working at the UNI student radio station, eventually becoming the program director.
My wife maintains that I lead a charmed life, and I am living proof of that possibility.
As luck would have it, Bob was hired as a student at the new UNI Broadcasting Services Department, and they put him behind a mic and on the air the first day they started broadcasting.
In the very first night of rock and roll radio on a Iowa public radio station, I did. I was scared beyond my wildest dreams, but that was the beginning, and here I am at the end, 43 years later as in October, so wow.
One of Bob's earliest shows on public radio KHKE and KUNI was called Progression. Producing and hosting Progression gave him the opportunity to rub shoulders with some amazing musicians.
Oh, I got to meet a whole bunch of really cool people. I went to see Muddy Waters at Luther College in Decorah and had heard from people that he liked champagne. And so, on a whim, I went and bought a $10 bottle of champagne, which, again, in the mid-70s for a college kid was an enormous amount of money. And I found his manager, and the guy, he doesn't do any interviews, doesn't do any of that. And I said, but I have this bottle of champagne. And it was like it was the key to heaven or something. I said the magic word champagne. Okay, Muddy will talk. And so we sat in the women's locker room at Luther College in Decorah, sipping champagne out of styrofoam cups. And there I am in the presence of this guy that I thought was God, and we're drinking champagne out of styrofoam cups. But I got to meet and talk with a whole lot of people, everybody from Thin Lizzy guy, Phil Lynott, the late Irish bass player and songwriter, Willie Dixon, the greatest blues songwriter Eva. I got to meet him in the back room dressing room at Gabe's Oasis in Iowa City and talk with him. So yeah, public radio really kind of opened the door to be able to meet a lot of just really, really cool people. All BB King, I got to meet him, got to do a couple of dates with BB King. That was fun. So yeah, again, just really lucky.
While at UNI, Bob exchanged playing in bands for going to school and becoming a radio personality. That all changed when he attended Bruce Springsteen's Hanger performance. That concert changed Bob's life. Bob started a touring band and moved to Minneapolis. Eventually, he decided to return to radio and reshape his band. On June 10th of 1981, Bob Doerr and the Blue Band gave their first performance in Dubuque. He started juggling Blue Band gigs with his radio show production. In 2002, Bob was inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with the Blue Band being inducted in 2007. And in 2005, he was also installed into the Iowa Blues Hall of Fame.
I always go back to the famous Van Morrison line of, "It's too late to stop now." And that's been my philosophy forever. Surround yourself with really good people, stand back and let them make me look good. And by golly, they've done a wonderful job.
Iowa Blues legend Bob Doerr. You can hear Bob Doerr's shows on IPR's News and Studio One streams. Backtracks airs on Saturday afternoons between 2 and 5. Blue Avenue airs on Sunday afternoons from 5 to 6:30. It is followed by the Beatles Medley from 6:30 to 7. To read more about Bob, you need to get your hands on a copy of the July-August edition of the Iowan Magazine. To find a performance schedule for the Blue Band, check their website, theblueband.com. To enjoy more segments from Bob's behind-the-scenes interview, click on the Iowa Art Showcase link under the classical drop-down menu on our iowapublicradio.org website. Don't go away. The music of the March King returns to Iowa, and an iceberg arrives in Dubuque, but does it melt? This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The Titanic exhibit really is a personal experience for everybody. When you come in, you're going to get a boarding pass for a passenger who was on Titanic. So you'll find out who you were, why you were on Titanic, where you were going, where you were from. And then at the end of the exhibit, you can match that up on our memorial walls to see if you survived or perished. And as you're going through the exhibit, you imagine you're this person. And was I first class or third class? Would I have dined here? Would I have used those dishes? So it really makes it a personal experience. And this is a new model for us, bringing in a blockbuster exhibit. We've never done this before. It's the largest exhibit we've ever done. And we were happy to bring this exhibit to Dubuque to our visitors.
The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's director, John Sutter. The museum and aquarium is located on the Port of Dubuque on the Mississippi River.
Our mission is to educate about the entire Mississippi River and all the rivers of America. So from Lake Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico, all 2,552 miles, and all the culture and history and animals and environments you would encounter along the way. And then in 2010, we opened the National River Center, so we broadened our reach to talk about all the rivers of North America and how they affect the oceans. Of course, rivers all end in the oceans and into the Gulf of Mexico, specifically with the Mississippi River. So we talk about the global connections from what people do here in Iowa or anywhere along the Mississippi River or any river in the United States and how that affects the health of our oceans.
Tell us a little bit about the museums. You have interesting swimming things and other things as well.
It's a 10-acre campus, and we have two main buildings. We have the Mississippi River Center, which focuses on the Mississippi, and it also has our changing exhibit gallery. Then we have the National River Center, which houses our River Ways exhibit, which is the cultural history of all of America's rivers. We have our Rivers to the Sea exhibit that talks about the Gulf of Mexico, so that's where you'll find our octopus, our sharks, our cow nose rays, our rescued sea turtle over there. We have a 3D 4D theater. Right now we're in partnership with National Geographic to provide those films. And we have a kids splash zone where kids can build a boat and float it down the river and do all kinds of fun stuff with water. Then our exterior, our outside part of our campus, we have a national historic landmark, the William M. Black, which is a 300-foot long steam-powered dredge boat, and that's docked in the harbor and available for tours. We also have aviaries outside. We have two bald eagles. We have a rescued red-tailed hawk and a children's play area, all kinds of fun stuff to do outside, a log cabin, a Native American wiki-up, and a living wetland.
The ship, the Titanic, was thought to be unsinkable. John tells us about their visiting show, Titanic, the Artifact Exhibition.
It has been a phenomenal exhibit for us. And it's a traveling exhibit, so these artifacts came from the Titanic wreckage site. And the exhibit takes you through the whole story of Titanic, from the building of it, to the wonder of the Gilded Age, to life on board the boat, and then, of course, the disaster. And then there's a memorial room also where you can see the list of passengers who have survived and who haven't. And there's a lot of debate about, you know, the what ifs of this disaster, as with any disaster. But you get to experience that in the exhibit, because when you come to that part of the exhibit, the lighting changes and it gets dark. We have a refrigerated iceberg in there, so it gets colder. So you really feel this impending doom coming. And then you can learn about that and try to decide for yourself what really happened.
I suppose when one is thinking about having an exhibit, having an iceberg arrive is not one of the usual things that you get.
Yeah, it's a refrigerated panel that looks like an iceberg, simulated iceberg. So you can touch it, and it's about 3 or 4 feet thick now. So it's pretty impressive, and it does cool the whole room.
Tell us about this film that you have that is in conjunction with this exhibit.
Yeah, in our 3D 4D theater, we're now showing a National Geographic film by James Cameron. It's called Challenger Deep, or Deep Sea Challenge, where James Cameron hired a team of scientists to build a submarine to go to the deepest part of the ocean, located in the Mariana Trench. It's over 7 miles below the surface of the sea. Fewer people have been there than have been to the moon. That's how remote it is and how difficult it is to get there. And you see the technological process and the idea of exploration and deep sea exploration to find this and discover new species and new worlds and answer some questions that we don't have the answer to yet. And another film we have in our 3D 4D theater is Robots 4D. And it's National Geographic's newest film. It hasn't been on television. It hasn't been released on DVD yet. And it's in our 4D theater, and it's about humanoid robots, narrated by Simon Pegg, who plays Scotty in the new Star Trek series. It's really an entertaining look at the marvel of these humanoid-looking robots and what they can do, and how amazing the human body is that it's hard to replicate. They're just now getting a robot that can jump. And of course, humans can jump from the time they can walk. They can lift both feet off the ground. But to get a robot to do that, it's difficult. So you can learn about that in our movie, and kids have really been enjoying that robot film.
So how can folks get more information and details about this Titanic and about the museum?
The best place to go is to our website at rivermuseum.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can follow us there.
Dubuque's National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's director, John Sutter. If you want to see their Titanic, the Artifact exhibition, it continues through Labor Day. Other events that will be held at the Museum and Aquarium this month include their Toddler Tuesday, their Hands-on River Adventure Summer Camp, and their 20th Annual Taste of Dubuque Festival to be held on August 7th. To hear John provide more historical insight and details about the Titanic disaster, please click on the Iowa Art Showcase link under the classical drop-down menu on our iowapublicradio.org website. Just ahead, internationally acclaimed conductor Keith Bryan and the new Sousa Band head to Iowa. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Sousa came to Des Moines 22 times over his career, over 40 years. Played the last time at the State Fair. And this was a big part of Iowa's life. And he played in all of the smaller cities all over the state. So Sousa is not around in our lifetime, but this was a great thing in somebody else's lifetime. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see what that great thing was, because it's no longer available because Sousa isn't here anymore. So that was basically the reason I started this in 1978, and it's still the reason I'm doing it.
Keith Bryan, music director of his own new Sousa Band. The new Sousa Band will be presenting 2 free concerts in Iowa. Tomorrow evening, they perform at the Johnston Common in Johnston, and on Monday, the band will be performing at the Sammy Bedell Theater in Spirit Lake. While Keith now conducts famous bands and orchestras from all around the globe, his musical career got off to an unusual start.
My parents were not musical, but my father rented public address systems for various political rallies and things. So when I was very young, probably 2 or 3 years old, the only recordings in the house were Sousa marches that he put on his sound systems for political rallies. Looking back on it, it seems that that was my cradle music, the only music that was available in our house when I was little. So, you know, you can't knock early childhood and what it does to you.
So what instrument did you play? Were you in band when you were a young kid?
I wanted to play an instrument, and I found a clarinet in a pawn shop that my parents could afford, and the band director told me it was too old, it really wasn't going to work. So the next thing I thought of, I joined the band, and since I didn't play an instrument, I helped carry the bass drum in the parade. And that was pretty hard work, actually. So one time at one of these parades, I heard the piccolo player warming up, and I thought, oh, that's it. That's what I should do. So I ended up with the smallest instrument. And I did have a career as a professional piccolo player with several symphony orchestras along the way.
So you were also a longtime band educator and a music supervisor for the New Jersey Public Schools.
That's correct.
And then you founded the New Jersey Wind Symphony.
Yeah, North Jersey Wind Symphony. It was quite a good group, somewhere between amateur and professional. And then we got a grant from the State Arts Council and started hiring professional players. And Gerard Schwartz, who's just retired from the Seattle Symphony, was my first trumpet in that group. It was really terrific. We made a recording, and it sort of led to, eventually, to my position at Yale.
And you did some pretty impressive things with concerts with that band.
Yeah, it was fun. We did a lot of touring, Florida, West Coast, Texas, a big tour to Europe in 1976 when the Europeans were interested in presenting American groups for the American Bicentennial.
When did you decide that you wanted to replicate and become with the original uniforms and have this band and really get into this? How did this all evolve?
Well, I conducted both the Yale Marching Band and the Yale Concert Band, and the Yale Marching Band was famous for doing crazy things, so there was a small element of humor in the whole business. But with the Concert Band, we did all kinds of things, an evening of Italian band music, for instance, just to give you one idea. We did concerts with P.D. Bach, a whole list of things. So one day I was reading a biography of Sousa that mentioned that he had been conducting in the Yale Concert Hall in, I believe, 1914, and been stricken with malaria and had to be carried off the stage in a stretcher. And I thought that was very, very dramatic. So I was quite moved by that. It just seemed like a sense of place. This is where we give our concerts. The great Sousa had been carried off the stage in a stretcher. And I thought, well, isn't it too bad that the great Sousa was dead, but nobody has an opportunity anymore to see him, to hear his concerts, to do that whole thing. It was the greatest touring attraction in America for 40 years. It was more important at that time than the Boston Pops is today. It was a very big deal. So it occurred to me that maybe somehow we could bring that back in the same place with that same sort of idea. Initially, what I thought about was dressing the band up to look like the Sousa band, because the Yale band wore dark blue blazers, and it wouldn't be too hard to rig them up, kind of fake a stand-up collar with them and make the band appear like Sousa's band. I had absolutely no idea of appearing as Sousa, however. And once I had talked the band into looking like the Sousa band, they said, you have to do this too, and they really cornered me. So at the very last minute, I powdered my hair white and got a fake mustache and and white gloves and tried to fake it that I looked like Sousa. So that all happened when we did the first performance, which was in January 1978.
And the rest is history?
Yeah. The head of the Yale Concert Office at the time was a former music editor of Life magazine, and he really thought the project was terrific and took it under his wing, promoted it both in New Haven and also later got the idea of taking it to Carnegie Hall and got the New York Times, Harold Schoenberg, to write about it. Then Harold Schoenberg later reviewed it, gave it a rave review when we played in Carnegie Hall. And an agent called me up and signed me up, and here I am, 35 years later, still doing it.
Keith discusses the major impact John Philip Sousa had on music making in America.
Sousa was really the father of the modern pops concert. He developed the genre, and in my view, he perfected it to a degree that nobody's ever equaled. During the 1920s, when he was touring with his own band and playing in Boston Symphony Hall, Arthur Fiedler would come to scout the Sousa band. And basically, the original Boston Pops, when Fiedler started it, was copying what Sousa had done. There's almost a direct connection today between the Boston Pops and Sousa's band. Even though one is an orchestra and one is a band, there really wasn't much difference in the programming. However, one important difference was that Sousa played an encore after every piece on the program, and Fiedler decided to put the encores all in the same place in the program. And I've conducted the Boston Pops. It's a very different feeling when you change it. At any rate, that's the genius of Sousa's programming. And people that come to see it, even though Sousa died in 1932, when they get an idea of how this music works with lots of encores, lots of fun pieces, lots of pieces interspersed with other pieces, and no fooling around on the stage, it's just one piece after another, they'll get an idea of how much fun it was during Sousa's time to go to one of these concerts. When we did it for the first time at Yale, I was absolutely dumbfounded with the audience reaction. Because when you take something that had died essentially in 1932 and present it to a modern audience, it might be relevant, it might not, but it was super relevant. The delight of the audience was almost overwhelming. And it's continued to this day. It's quite a phenomena. Sometimes we feel like we found a magic lamp and rubbed it and the genie came out. So the real surprise in Sousa is that these concerts are a lot of fun. They're really fun to go to. If you don't like some piece that's going on, pretty soon something else will come along that you do like. So it's great for audiences. And that's the biggest misconception today, is that a Sousa concert would be, for instance, all marches. No, he would play a lot of classical music, he would have an opera singer sing, he would have novelty pieces that were a lot of fun, play things from operettas, popular music of the day, all of it all mixed up and jumbled like a stew. And our performances copy that idea, and people that come to hear us will hear that same kind of mixture. It's really terrific and a lot of fun.
Keith mentions the four soloists who will be performing with the new Sousa Band in Johnston and in Spirit Lake. He also discusses how Sousa incorporated solo performances into his programs.
There was always a different soloist standing up, and then there'd be a few marches or something else played, and then another soloist would come, another. It all moves very quickly and nicely. Mark Ponzo is going to play a cornet solo written by Sousa's cornet soloist, Herbert L. Clark. Mark is a professor of trumpet at Northern Illinois University. Then Virginia Crossgree, who teaches voice at Simpson College, is going to come out and sing an aria and a lighter piece by Victor Herbert. She's a terrific soprano. She will also appear doing a Jerome Kern piece in the second half of the program. And then at the end, we're having a kind of a humorous duet, The Whistler and His Dog, with Tacy Edwards, fantastic piccolo player, and Don Harry, who's kind of the dean of America's tuba players. He's the tuba teacher at the Eastman School of Music and studied with Sousa's tuba player, William Bell, and also is the tuba player with the Buffalo Philharmonic. So it's kind of typical of the players we have. They're from orchestras all around the country. We have a former first trumpet of the Marine Band playing. The whole band is like that. A lot of university professors, wind and percussion people, play as well.
And Virginia Crossgree, she went on tour with you to Japan.
Yes, she has toured with us, and she has sung with major symphony orchestras as well as with the new Sousa Band.
Key says the new Sousa Band members each have 20 to 25 years of experience and are all steeped in the performing style of Sousa. He outlines a typical Sousa program and hints at what the new Sousa Band will be performing during their upcoming Iowa concerts.
It's a very typical Sousa program, and the first thought, I'm sure your listeners would have, that this is a program of all Sousa, and nothing could be further from the truth. At most, it's one-third Sousa, and that's absolutely typical of Sousa's own performances. Very typically, Sousa would begin a concert with an overture. We'll be playing Montsoupe's Light Cavalry Overture. and then probably there'll be a march encore, and then a cornet solo by Susan's solo cornetist called The Debutante, and there'll be an encore to that. Then we're playing a piece of Percy Grainger's that Susan sometimes performed the Colonial Song. He was very fond of Grainger's music and played a great deal of it. Probably a Susan march for an encore. And then the soprano comes out and looks gorgeous and sings gorgeously. And then we're doing the Verdi's Grand March from Aida. And again, there'll probably be a Susan march for an encore. Second half, we're doing a set of humorous variations that Susan wrote in the 1920s on George Gershwin's tune, Swanee, kind of a parody of Val Jolson's recording of it. And it's a very interesting thing. Susan fancied himself as sort of also the Spike Jones of his time and could write very funny musical sketches, and this is one of them. And again, it'll be followed probably by a Susan march as an encore. And Virginia's going to sing, again, All the Things You Are, the Jerome Kern piece. And then we're doing selections from the Pirates of Penzance. It's kind of interesting because when Sousa took over the Marine Band, almost the first thing he did was arrange this show, the Pirates of Penzance, for the Marine Band while it was still doing its first run on Broadway in 1880. So we're going to be doing that. Another Sousa march likely for an encore, and as you can see, this goes on and on. And then we're doing a piccolo and tuba duet, The Whistler and His Dog, again, something very popular in his time, and still is played on cartoons and so on. Everyone will know what it is. And then we're doing a little patriotic finale with some George M. Cohan tunes, God Bless America, Salute to Military Services, and the most obvious finale, The Stars and Stripes Forever. So that's a quickie. There'll be a lot of pieces, but they'll be over quickly. But we'll probably play over 20 pieces on the program, but they just go bang, bang. It's a lot of fun. It'll be a different concert experience for the people that come because it just whizzes by.
So why is it important to keep the music of Sousa alive? Why is it important to do these kinds of concerts?
You know, it makes people happy. I've been doing this for 35 years, and I've just, you know, see people walking out of the theater or out of the concerts with just smiles on their faces. It's almost enough right there to do it. It's fun. It's really fun. That's my best answer. And I think it's terrific music. I think it's interesting. I think it absorbs people. I think it keeps their attention from first note to the last. All of those things. But in the end, it's definitely feel-good stuff. And I just hope lots of people will come out. These are both free concerts. It's a lot of fun. And they'll thank themselves if they come.
The new Sousa Band's music director and conductor, Keith Bryan. Thanks to the generosity of the Des Moines Civic Music Association, the new Sousa Band will be presenting two free concerts in Iowa. Tomorrow evening at 7, they'll perform at the Johnston Common in Johnston. And on this coming Monday night, August 3rd at 7, the band will be performing at the Sammy Bedell Theater in Spirit Lake. To hear Keith Bryan talk about his Sousa and Hovhaannis recording series and supply more historical details about Sousa's life and career, please click on the Iowa Art Showcase link under the Classical drop-down menu on our iowapublicradio.org website. Today's Iowa Art Showcase August broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for listening. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.